It's a pleasure to have you on this podcast, and it's a privilege too.
Thank you, Adrian. Happy to be here. And like I said, if you ask for something, I doubt anybody in the world can say no to you. So go for it.
So I thought I would love to have a conversation with you in three broad overlapping parts. You've had a remarkable career. You're a successful producer, director of film and theatre. You have won innumerable awards. You are the advisor to many government initiatives of national significance and international significance. And you have created and led a remarkable company, Teamworks, about which I would like you to say more. Who is Sanjoy Roy, and how did you get to be Sanjoy Roy, as it were? What was the trajectory? I think people are always interested in the lives that people have forged for themselves, particularly younger listeners who are trying to figure out their own lives in tumultuous times.
So, Adrian, much of my life has been by accident, as opposed to what Harvard Business School teaches, that, you know, one had a plan and a plot, which was, you know, 5, 10, 15 years to take over the world. None of that really was in any way a reckoning when I first started off. I've always been in theater and always got into trouble, not necessarily because I've been in theater, but there has been a sort of overlap in university. I used to do a lot of street theater, set up my own theater company, got entangled with problems with the law because I was protesting about something or the other against the government of the time, used theater to bring about social change, started a street children's organization roughly when I was, 22 or 23. When I left university, I was already part of this theater company, Theater Action Group, which was a preeminent theater company based in Delhi, and its creative director was Barry John. I was his executive director, first its manager, and then I was kicked upstairs as its executive director, which is where I met my to-be wife, who thought I was pretentious and thought I was annoying and wanted to wield power unnecessarily. And it was in the course of our courtship, I mean, she didn't know that she was in love with me, and she thought that we had a brother-sisterly relationship, which sort of blew my mind because I'm like, no, that's not quite it. I think you need to just re-examine where exactly this relationship is going. And when she popped the question to me in terms of us getting engaged, and I was introduced to her father, my future father-in-law asked of me, so young man, what do you do? The famous question that most father-in-laws ask their prospective, supposedly son-in-laws. And I, of course, said that I did theater. So he said, no. I mean, what's your day job? And I'm going, yes, I do theater and I run this theater company and I pay myself what used to be an equivalent of about $20 or $30 a month. And he wasn't impressed at all. And so he said, I really think you should take a job. And I'm like, no. I am a theater person, and that's roughly what I do. As we got closer to the wedding, he asked me again. He said, so, you know, what do you do? And how are you going to be supporting my daughter? So I said, hey, you know, just so that there's no misunderstanding here, your daughter is the manager of a very big company, and she's going to be supporting us. I mean, I'm the artist. I'm in theater. And that's my world. And so that's what the reality is. Obviously, it didn't go down too well with him. And it was roughly at that time in India, what happened is that television started opening up from being completely in the domain of the public broadcaster, which was called Doordarshan, which is the government, a terrestrial channel in those days, in the mid-80s, early 80s. And they started opening up, and a number of producers who had got slots or time slots on the main channel started looking around to create interesting serials and soap operas and game shows and blah, blah, blah. And there wasn't really any television professionals in the country outside of those already engaged with Doordarshan. So people like that then came to people like us who were, you know, in a relatively sort of engaged part of the arts. So Bobby Bedi, who had then already produced a number of award-winning films, etc., kept coming to me a number of times and saying, you have to come and direct this series, and I used to say, no way, you know, and I will never sell my soul to the devil of television, and I'm a pure theater person. But like as the wedding grew closer and closer, and my father-in-law started getting even more frenetic about this to-be engagement and wedding, I then went and took my first job and directed a game show, which was a ripoff on a European show called Telematch. So we had a version called Telefun, and I did that for a couple of years, helped him do a couple of films. And thereafter, my partner and I mean, he was part of the advertising company, which was part of this larger umbrella company that I was working in, BB Video Graphics. And Mohit said to me, listen, why don't we just set up something ourselves? Because I know you want to do something that you want to do, not necessarily just commercial rubbish. So I was game. So in 1987, as part of the theater company, we set up what then was called TAG TV. TAG was the name of the theater company. And our primary motivation was to provide jobs for our colleagues in theater so that during the day they would have a way to earn a living. And in the evening, we would all go and merrily rehearse in rehearsal rooms somewhere in the city and stage our plays and live out our passion. That sort of changed at some point. And then in 1989, we set up a Teamwork Films at that point of time. And initially, we did films primarily for NGOs and people like UNICEF and World Bank, etc. So these were films, these were a series of documentaries and advocacy films on everything from diarrhea to tuberculosis to, you know, work around television, but more on the advocacy campaign sort of route. So we worked in Bangladesh and we worked in Africa. And purely by accident, by which time we'd done this wonderful film for KLM, Cargo, which we shot in Jaipur with a slew of elephants and camels in the forests of Jaipur. And what used to happen every morning is that when we started shooting, by about 10 o'clock in the morning, we used to get arrested because we were apparently trespassing in this forest without permission. And we were sort of relegated to our hotel room. So we were under hotel arrest. And as it happened, my comrade in arms at that point of time was a person called Shah Rukh Khan, who worked with us and then went on to become, you know, one of India's, the world's big megastar actors. So we used to get confined to this hotel room every morning. And then we used to find a way to get out of that. And we used to go off and try to start shooting. So we had to unarrest our elephants and get them unchained and the camels and so on and so forth. But as it happened, this film really won every award there was at that point of time in advertising. And therefore, some interesting work came our way, which allowed us to pick and choose what we wanted to do. I think this was 89, 90. Television went completely private. So you didn't have to anymore work on the national broadcaster or buy time on the national broadcaster. You could actually just work with any of the new channels, Star TV, ZTV, which has just come into its own, and so on and so forth. And because we were already sort of in the mix, naturally, most of these television channels came to us to say, what will you create for us? We not knowing any better said, you know, we'll create this and we'll do that show and this show and so on and so forth. And by 1994, 95, we had about 15 daily, weekly soap operas, game shows, food programs, news programs, puppet shows, theater projects, all on television, which were either on a daily basis or a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis. And in many ways, we were a factory, Adrian, where we used to just sort of churn them out because, you know, television is unrelenting and television has no sense of a soul. And in those days, what used to happen is that there was no sense of a season either. So if your program was successful and made the channel money, because the channel basically was living off its producers, they used to pay us in a 90 or 120 day cycle. We produced the stuff, sent it off to them. They made the money of the advertising, paid us after 120 days. So they never stopped. So all our programs, these 15 or 14 or 15 soap operas, game shows, etc., were running every day, every week, every month, year on year. And every Saturday, I used to meet with my colleagues. We used to call it SAM, the Saturday afternoon meeting, where all our directors and producers of the different shows used to come together. They used to tell me what their problems are. We used to look at the next week's episodes, look at some of the creative input, and basically look at who was a bad puppy, which actor had behaved badly and needed to be written out or shot at the next episode, or how did we need to convert something to make it more interesting, etc. And two of our colleagues, two of our senior producer directors, Manika Berry and Sharupa Datta, they came to me one day and said, we are brain dead. We can't do this anymore. We wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, make our way to Film City, go from studio to studio because, you know, we were in every studio in Film City because we had so many projects. And then we come back home at 1 o'clock. We can't do this anymore. And in a moment of foolishness, and I'm, you know, fairly foolish, as you know, Adrian, I said, okay, if nobody wants to do this, that's fine. Let's shut it down. And, you know, we calculated the math and we said, okay, the television channels owe us money for X number of months. We'll be fine. Let's rethink. Let's go back to our roots of the arts. Except that we didn't calculate that the television channels would have nothing of the sort. And they were really upset that we were going to shut down. And they withheld our money. They threatened us. It went completely pear-shaped. And we had taken on a very humongous project by which time, our first sort of live entertainment, a big television award, the first big Indian television award called the Oneida Awards after a television set called Oneida. And it was gigonymous. I mean, we flew around the country. I had tickets to every city at every hour because we were doing jury meetings and selection committees and flying in. We created an academy. We flew everybody around. It was humongous. Except in doing all of this, I think we literally bankrupted that particular company. So they went down the tube pretty much after this big sort of unbelievable successful first television awards, transparent, audited, etc. The news companies the television channels didn't pay up. And we realized in 1995, 96, we were pretty out on a limb, having literally sawed off the branch on which we were sitting on. And in many ways, that was a whole, you know, because as I said, we had become this mega company and it was a factory. So we started losing people. People started leaving, obviously, because we weren't being able to pay salaries. And in this reinvention, what had happened is my partner Mohit, his sister and this great friend of ours had created something called Friends of Music, which was a platform for people to come together once a month in Delhi in an interesting place, be it somebody's house, a heritage monument, whatever, and do music which wasn't popular. So no Bollywood, no rock, but something that was experimental. And so that became our focus, even as we started going downhill and out of television. And that became very successful, Adrian. And it became the sort of go-to place. And because it was very successful, we started doing the same thing in dance. We commissioned a lot of new dance. We worked with contemporary and classical dancers of the times. And we said, what is it that you would love to do if somebody gave you a free hand but never could do? And they all came up with some interesting ideas and we honed it and we commissioned it. And we did the same in theater. We commissioned new writing. And as I said, till then, much of English theater in India, Adrian, was either ripoffs of off-Broadway or off-Western shows. And there was no real original writing coming out in English in India. So we started commissioning new writing and we did it across Hindi and English. And of course, there were some that were fabulous and had great audiences. And there were some that I just couldn't bear and they won lots of awards and all of that kind of stuff. And then we realized we had all of this content, Adrian, but there were no platforms in India really to showcase this. And we were now talking about 1999. And you know, in 1995, 96, roughly when we were going down the tube, what had happened is that we had gone off to Goa for our annual holiday with our kids. And in that process, on the 6th of June, which is something, you know, I have a face reader who comes to the office every now and then. And he had said that, you know, 6th of June, what are you going to be doing? So I said, why? He said, oh, no, nothing. But, you know, why don't you just stay at home? I said, but why? He said, no, not at, don't worry, just staying. But if you're going to be somewhere outside, why don't you just stay in your room? So anyway, needless to say, we'd forgotten what 6th of June was supposed to be. We sallied forth, and these friends of ours were driving their motorbikes. We were, Punita and I were on the back of these two bikes. As we were about to speed off, she tapped me on the shoulder and said, exchange bikes. You go on that one, I'll go on this one. They sped into the first rains that come in Goa. There was mist on the road. It was midnight. We were all fairly inebriated. And they sped off in the night. And as we arrived at the Taj holiday village, Taj Aguada, we saw this bike with its wheels spinning, three bodies laid out. Punita was out like a light. She had a hemorrhage. Her eye had hemorrhaged. Her brain had a concussion. And that resulted in a year which was very difficult between hospital and so on and so forth. So I hadn't cut my hair, Adrian. I let my hair grow because I just didn't have time. And one day our elder son, Aditya, came to me and said, are you planning to grow your hair? And I'm like, why? So he said, if you grow your hair, you're not going to be allowed to come to my school. And I'm going, yes, no more parent-teacher meeting to be told what a bad parent you are. And no more sports days on those ghastly annual days that you have to suffer through because your kids are in school. So I grew my hair. And as my hair was always somewhat salt and pepper, I got invited by university, especially in the UK, because they thought, oh, he speaks our language, he looks artistic, he's got long hair. And diversity, if you remember, was the big flavor of the season at that point. So I used to go out and teach for British Council and lecture at all sorts of places. And that led to a network being created, which led to my going to the Edinburgh Festival in 1999, 2000. And I was absolutely besotted and fascinated to see this incredible mix of energy, of creativity, of the world, the center of the universe, the thousands of shows, a lot of them rubbish, but some amazing. And I was like, oh, wow, this is the place that we need to bring some of our work. So in 2001, we set up our first platform at the Edinburgh festivals. But the only thing that we did differently, Adrian, is that, as you know, most people would either do the festival fringe or do the literature festival. Or if you went to the Edinburgh International Festival, you didn't go to the fringe. If you went to the tattoo, you didn't go anywhere else. If you went to the television and film festival, you didn't do it. Except that we decided that we would program across festivals and market it under one banner, which we did. And it was enormously successful, and which is what Edinburgh then, the festivals then sort of adapted to many, many years later. And as they say, the minute you get that kind of stamp of credibility, and we were able to network with Australia and New Zealand and the United States and Canada and all of these places, that led us to set up our first international office in 2001, 2002 in Singapore. Adrian, one of our colleagues, Shweta, who you met in Singapore, she was moving to Singapore. So she said, I'm happy to set up. And the then minister of META had said to us, we would really like you to do something and bring, you know, the arts and blah, blah, blah to Singapore. And I remember he first asked me, he said, so what do you think you would have achieved in 10 years? Will everybody play the violin or play the piano or some sort? And I was like, oh, well, some people will play the violin and some people may learn to make films and some people will play the piano and some people will kick a football and some people may not do any of the above. But he wasn't too impressed with that thought. But because Esplanade Theatres by the Bay was about to be launched, they took us on board to advise them. We helped them with the launch. We then set up a festival with them, Kalaotsavam, which we ran for many, many years, over a decade and a half. And we expanded our work to Australia, Western Australia, New Zealand. And as they say, the rest is history. And then we started working our way back down west. And as I said, all of it was in many ways really accidental, Adrian. I remember in South Africa, to bring the story to an end, in South Africa, I remember our ambassador one day called me and said, the government is very keen to have you come and do what you did in New York needless to say, I'd forgotten what we had suggested in New York. So I made a racist remark. And I said, anyway, it's full of violence. I'm not coming there. There's no flatbed, and there's no direct flight. And there's nothing that's going to get me to that place. He said, no, I promise you come for a day. So anyway, I finally went for a day. I fly into Johannesburg. Ambassador Navdeep Suri's got all of these meetings lined up. And we meet the city. We meet Stephen Sachs. We meet the justices. We meet Standard Bank, FNB. And I was so taken by what I saw in Newtown, in Johannesburg, the crime, the vibrancy, this new democracy struggling with all of these issues, whether it was in Soweto or in Alexandria or wherever. And so what we offered, we said to Stephen Sachs, I said, Stephen, if you delineate an arts district in Newtown and ensure that there's great policing and street lighting, I promise that in 3 years' time, you know, anybody will be able to walk across Mary Fitzgerald Square. I certainly will with my mobile phone and my hand and a laptop, and I won't get mugged. And that came to pass because, as we all know, Adrian, in any cultural district, the minute you bring the artists in, restaurants follow, the LGBTQI community comes in. Artists comes in, it buzzes, they form a space, people come behind that, real estate comes in, restaurants, nightclubs, exhibition halls, conference centers, and all of that has come to pass. So those are some of the sort of accidents that have happened. So, and my life and the life of our company and all my colleagues is pretty entwined, you know, so if you're looking at work-life balance, yes, that would be a question, but I don't see my work very different from my life. All my hobbies, which is reading, watching theater, listening to music. I mean, it's a dream job.
What a wonderful story of both luck and the opportunity and the bravura capacity to take advantage of that luck, which is as important as the luck itself. So let's take 2019 rather than 2020 or 2021. How many countries is TeamWorks programming in for a year like 2019?
In 2019, before the lockdown, and our last festival, in fact, ended 6th of March, which was in Egypt, I think we were in 42 cities in 16 or 17 countries. It keeps changing, so I'm not entirely sure. Don't hold me to it. So Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Thailand, and then China, Japan, Russia, many parts of the European Union, Egypt, Turkey, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and then, of course, the United States, Canada, and some places in between.
There are people who talk about festivalization in a slightly pejorative tone. And I think that they mean two things. They mean the ascendancy of presentation over production. And I think they mean the a certain sort of indifference to place programmatically. I wonder what your disposition is to that sort of criticism of festivals as overly commodifying the artistic process.
Any process, you know, forget the festival for a second. Any process, if it doesn't have a soul and a raison d'être to exist, which should, I mean, in our case, we're very clear about why we do something. We do it because we like to look at the association between the arts to bring value to a built heritage. So that's one of the pillars that we look at. So whether it's Egypt or Turkey or India or Jaipur or Edinburgh, and that's really something in many ways that we learned from Edinburgh. How do you create value for built heritage so that people don't tear down these incredible historical buildings and make ways for, you know, malls and so on and so forth. So therefore, what programming is needed for that? The second area that we work with, and that's really an area that has found attraction, is where we look at the social need of the moment. So I'll give you an example. In Western Australia, when we first started working in Perth, and as I mentioned earlier, Adrian, one of the things that I am involved in is with street children. And our work with street children has really always started and centered around the arts and using the arts as therapy, using the arts in a way to get kids home, using the arts in a way to be able to heal them. And for example, Western Australia had appointed the first Aboriginal pediatrician. in Kalgoorlie, which your listeners may know is the largest open mine and the only one to be seen from outer space because it's so deep and so big. And in and around Kalgoorlie, in a 100-kilometer radius, the community of Aboriginal people, nomadic groups, I think there were 14 or 18 tribes, there was 100% incarceration rate in that area. And the Minister of Interiors in Western Australia, having invited me, said, can I look at doing something to bring about prison reform and relook at how can we work with these people? And I said to him, that's fine. Let's create a project. And I said, we need to do three things. One, record it. So we had the University of Western Australia record the findings. And the project was over 6 months. I said, we must do a video, whatever. And what I said is that when we do the project, this is after we had examined and met with all of these people, all of the community leaders, I said, make sure that you send out the dole truck, the supermarket truck, and the booze truck to these communities. Otherwise, what used to happen, Adrian, is that these people every Thursday or Friday, depending on when they got their dole, came to the closest town, got their dole, went to the bar, went to the supermarket, were robbed because they didn't know how to count, went to the brothel, came out, got into a fight, were arrested, and therefore you had 100% incarceration. So all we did is we created a gigantic visual arts project in the desert. Of course, I mean, to my chagrin, it actually spread over 100-mile radius, which you could only see from a helicopter, so it became a little fancy, but forget that. We told each of the communities, please tell us your stories of the universe, of the stars, of the water, of the animals, of the lizards, of your life, and tell it to us with music, tell it to us with your art, and create a desert installation. And in that six-month period, Adrian, the incidence level came down to 26% from 100% of incarceration. I mean, how better an example can you get? I mean, you know, fast forward to what we did in South Africa, where we worked in, in Cape Town, with, again, communities that didn't have access to everything, where Punita was working with young kids and young people. And again, enormous transformation. In Egypt and Turkey, we turned that around, and in Israel, where we looked at working with minority communities to look at saying things which they couldn't otherwise would be allowed to say because of the present narrative or the dispensation. And so all our programming has always focused on that. And even today, when you look at whether it's the Jaipurs or the Hong Kongs or the Singapores or whatever, Indonesia, etc. I give you Doha as an example. We were told you can't bring in Sufi music, you can't talk about the environment or fossil fuels, so forth. But we managed to do all of that. And we explained to the authorities who were funding it, we said, if you as a library don't push the boundaries, who will? If you want society to evolve, well, this is the place to be able to do so. So as long as you're programming with a clear intent and ensuring that what you're doing is not just about bringing the great and the good together for this fantastic, operatic, you know, brilliant show, of course you can do that too. But there has to be outreach, there has to be work in the community, there has to work through the year to be able to create that. And we look at festivals primarily as the end product of a long process, and to highlight and celebrate a year full of activities where the community themselves come together to give their best of themselves, to celebrate the best across the world, and jointly work to collaborate and showcase the arts of the region. So when you do that, then it's not just about cookie cutter festival stuff where you know, every festival you have, whatever, Coldplay or whoever. But you really do it with an understanding of the need of the moment. And the moment changes. Places change. Histories change. Narratives change. Reality changes. Governments change. And the need of the moment changes completely. And if you do not address that need of the moment, of course you're going to lose it. And of course you're going to create something that does not have deep roots in that particular society. And if you don't set down deep roots, then you're not going to be able to sustain anything that you've started, you know. And having set down deep roots, you must be adventurous enough to be able to experiment. Always push yourself, push your colleagues, push your partners. Think beyond, think into the future, you know, and always think young. Always have young people part of the process. So most of our festivals have been so successful because it's always catered to the young who've taken it upon themselves to make it their festival. I mean, in Egypt, when we started, it was when the Arab Spring swept through that part of the world. Egypt, 80% of Egypt depended on tourism. They were completely devastated. They again reached out, as it happened, to the same ambassador who was in South Africa. He said, can you please come? You know, they really need your help. So I came down, realized that the need of the moment was to build trust and safety. So we said to the Egyptian authorities, we will begin our festival in your Terminal 1, where aircrafts arrive to show that it's safe. And that then caught the attention and the fancy of the entire world. CNN and BBC and everybody captured it. And the Boston bombings happened just at that point of time, just after that. And Logan Airport authorities reached out to us and said, will you consider doing a festival for us in the airport? And I said, well, no, I won't, because Homeland Security is quite different from Egyptian security and the Egyptian airlines. So thank you, but no thank you. So you also have to learn when to say no and when something won't work, you know. And for every time that we've said a yes, I think we've said 9 no's before that.
One of the remarkable things that you have done and do is to create in, I suspect, clients who don't necessarily always understand the full import of what you're saying about the importance of process and the festival being as a result of process, persuading them, taking them on a journey too. I suspect that maybe some of your clients, particularly repeat clients, may understand that, but I'm sure you go into many discussions where what they think they want is something off a shelf, a franchise, if you like. And the reality of what you're offering them is a process that culminates in a festival that is bespoke and responds to what you describe as the needs of the moment and the needs of the place. Any tips on doing that?
Absolutely. Let me qualify that by saying that it's never been easy sailing. So everything that I've said, you know, it may sound easy and accidental and we've been so successful. Not entirely. You know, we've gone bankrupt and belly up many times over. It's just that one has had the belief that we will always emerge stronger as long as we can learn from what's happened. Yes, many clients want something that they've heard of or they think that they want. I'll give you an example of a particular city that came to us with a big bid recently in the heart of Europe. I went for lunch that the Speaker of the Parliament hosted for me. And in the course of the conversation, and I kept asking, so why would you want us to come here, you know, to a country which is very, very conservative? It's very white. It's not necessarily welcoming of immigrants or refugees. They had recently taken in a few thousand refugees, and they kept saying to me, no, that's the reason. We need to understand from you how to tackle diversity, because if we don't, we will be destined to become a failed society. So we need you to do this. And I was very impressed by the argument. As the lunch continued into the early evening and I probed some more, I realized that they had little interest in actuality of these refugees who had come in, and their interest was really to tick the box and to say to the European Union, see, we have addressed the issue of diversity. These guys who represent diversity have come in and blah, blah, blah. So I walked away from the table. On the other hand, fast forward to Boulder, or rewind to Boulder, Colorado, a place I didn't even know existed. And when I got this impassioned email bid from three people in Boulder, Colorado, who had met with their mayor, then mayor, and the universities, etc., and sent me an email, an impassioned email, is why they thought Boulder, Colorado was the place for us to set down our first stop for JLF, America. I was like, okay, I'm not sure where Boulder is. So I opened up the map and I realized it was near Denver. And as it happened, I was in Chicago. I was on my way to the Bay Area. And I said, okay, I'll stop by. Pick me up. Let's go and have a look and have a chat. I arrive at Denver Airport. There's snow. There's ice on the highway. Maruta, one of the three who had mailed me, receives me. As we're driving, speeding down the highway in America, these prairie dogs pop out onto the road. And I'm saying to Maruta, and I'm basically don't hit the brakes. But of course, she does hit the brakes. And everything goes into slow motion. And the car jackknives on the highway. We nearly, you know, roll over. But luckily, all the traffic stops because everybody sees what's happening. And we come to a shuddering halt. We're both safe and nothing's happened. And of course, we drive on to Boulder. We reach Boulder, having our lives having been saved, which is what I always marvel. And I said, that's a sign. That's a sign that says, okay, we have a bigger purpose here. I get to Boulder and the other two people who had sent this impassioned please said, and now we must take you to our mall. And so I started rolling my eyes and I said, these Americans and their malls. But the Boulder Mall was just amazing. It's an open air piazza, pretty much like in Italy, beautifully laid down, lovely places, you know, more hippie than you can think of, because if you remember, Colorado is still pretty much everything is legal now. And I just fell in love with Colorado. And in the 6 months that it took to make that decision of why Colorado, knowing that we may not find enough sponsorship, I kept asking the city, I said, why are you putting money into this? And the mayor there said the same thing, that we are a white alone town, a place of high network trust fund people. If we don't understand how to deal with diversity, this town will die. And I believed them because of the way they said it. And we sat down JLF Boulder, Colorado. So it's really about never take what you hear or see necessarily only at face value. Yes, go by your instinct, which is what I do. I remember in Texas, in Scottsdale, we signed, sealed, and delivered a very large arts project, many millions of dollars over a period of 5 years in the Scottsdale Center. We really needed the resources. We were going through a very rough time when this happened. And I kept meeting our partners there. And just instinctively, I just didn't think it would work. And one day I said to our partner, I said, explain to me, why is it that you want to do this? And the partner said, for me, it's only about the money. I want to leave my job, which was in this case in Microsoft. She was representing the company. And I want to leave my job and I want to do this. Which is fine, which is, you know, I'm not knocking that wish or desire, but it was the way that it was said. And I said, you know, the arts can't just be about the money, because sometimes it will happen, but a lot of the time it won't. You have to believe in what you're trying to do. And it is a slog. And you have to know that you're going to have to tell people that this is what it is. So you really have to follow your instinct and walk away. And where it comes to governments, Adrian, I'm not a shy boy, as you know. And I've always been happy to speak truth to governments. They may not all love to hear what I say or what we say or what we dole out. But until unless they're able to buy into what is their vision or what they should understand to be their vision for the greater good, you're doomed, because otherwise that the goalpost will always keep moving. So you need to be very clear about your intent, your vision. Are the governments or your clients or your sponsors or whoever, have they bought into your vision? And are they aware of what your vision is? Because a lot of people, when I walk into the room, have already said, of course, thank you so much. Great. We believe everything that you say. Till it comes to the minutiae and they say, oh, but we didn't mean that. Oh, my God, is that what you're going to do? And again, Singapore, for you as an example, Adrian, when we sat down the Asian Festival of First Films as a project with the Singapore government, I said to them, you cannot censor anything that we do. And they said, that's not possible. I said, then we can't do it. They said, we've never done it. I said, well, if you want us over a period of time to be able to empower young people and not so young people in Singapore to be able to think about the arts and be creative and think out of the box. You can't tell them you can't see this, do that, read that, talk about this. You have to open it up. So we came to a happy compromise. They said, okay, we will rate the films that you will show from whatever, R to whatever. So it's restricted view. And it has to be a restricted number of seats. I said, accepted. And we showed everything, Adrian. We showed everything from same-sex relationships and hippies and drugs and bestiality and the works, the whole nine yards. Incredible films. Of course, 5 years later, all the other organizations protested that we had this, whatever. And they objected. And of course, they shut it down. But at least we were able to get it going. So you have to get your, you said client, I would say partner, to buy into what is it that you are hoping or envisioning to create, not to achieve, because achieve is too big a word, but to create. And really, if they engage in that, if they buy into that, you're home and dry. And yes, you can then continue to change your own goalpost, taking everybody together. Not easy, but certainly something that, we've lived with. And a lot of our colleagues occasionally have said, you work in a way that, it's impossible. I mean, how can you do this? But you have to do what you have to do. And you have to do because it's your, whatever, intent, it's your desire, it's your love, it's your way of doing it. So, yeah.
So let's come to this moment. Many colleagues I've spoken to have described the current chapter they're in their professional lives as the most difficult that they've experienced. And it's difficult partly because their business models have collapsed, but it's also partly because the expectations of them are more demanding. They and their institutions are being held to account to a standard that perhaps they should always have been held to, but haven't always been held to. And so at the very time at which their audiences have been locked out or locked down, they are also going through profound internal reorganization or demands for internal reorganization. Tell me your experience, or rather distill, if you like, your experience of these extraordinary pressures that we are currently feeling.
So, Adrian, I came screeching back home from the UK via Morocco on the 3rd of March, and I remember I was with Lindy Cook, who used to be with Hay Festivals, and we were on, Lindy represents us in the UK. And we were riding the underground, which I very rarely do, but we were on that particular occasion. And I turned to Lindy and I said, Lindy, just imagine if ever COVID got here, what would happen? Little knowing that it had already got there. By the time I got to Morocco, and I got to Morocco because I had to go and attend our press conference announcing our festival, which was going to happen at the end of March, and then made my way home on the 3rd or the 4th of March, you could see that everything was coming to a standstill. We just about finished Egypt on the 6th of March, and we canceled Turkey, came back, and in March, I think we canceled $3 million worth of our festivals. So we canceled Hong Kong, we canceled Morocco, Turkey, our Meta, our big theater festival. That was a lot of money. And I kept wondering, how are we going to do this? 20th of March, I hosted a wedding reception in my house of two of our colleagues because we realized that this lockdown was coming. They shouldn't wait to do a big, ta-da, grand Indian wedding. They should just come to our home, get married, and go to the court behind our house, get married, come home. I'd host them a reception. We did that. 23rd of March, Sunday, the lockdown happened. And that morning, my colleague, my long hair, because of my long hair, as you know, I sit on many of these organizations. I used to be the president of the Events and Entertainment Management Association, EMA. And one of my colleagues from there, our vice president, North, came to me and he said, sir, it's the lockdown. Why can't we do a 12-hour music program starting tomorrow at 6 o'clock and ending whatever? And I said, Vipul, are you serious? How can we pull this off? We have no technology. How will we get... He said, sir, we are the biggest organization associated. We can't do it. Who will? So I reluctantly, let me tell you, reluctantly said, okay, thinking that he would fail and he would call me in the next couple of hours and say, this is not going to get off the ground. We did it. Thousands of people came online to view it. And that inspired me. It wasn't my idea, but it inspired me, Adrian. And therefore, when the formal lockdown happened from the Monday, which was the 24th, I went back to my colleagues and I said, hey, what are we going to do? We're going in a lockdown. Are we going to just disappear and go into the woodwork? I said, we have resources. I promise you your salaries for this month. We have resources for the next 3 months. I will not let anybody go. If we have to swim together, we will. If we have to sink together, we shall. But let's think of what we can do. And what happened, Adrian, it really became an opportunity. One is that because we were all forcefully here in our homes on Zoom or wherever it was, and we weren't busy being busy, as all of us typically are, we sat down and we ideated and we thought and we reinvented. And the 4th of April, we got GLF Brave New World up and running. And we didn't have an ambition. My thing was, as condominiums and gated communities and cities and towns were ceding from the countries that they were part of, countries were closing their borders, I said, for this, for any kind of solution to happen for COVID, what is the need of the moment but the free flow of knowledge and information, which is something that we've always supported. I said, can we work together with all our university partners in Chicago and New York and Harvard and Australia and, you know, wherever else? I said, let's work together. Let's get the medical guys on board and get them to start talking about what does this mean? Can we get the first discoveries out? And that's what we did. We had Sharad Paul from New Zealand talking about the early day discoveries. We had people talking about how they walked through the market where the pangolins were and what they discovered. We had Dr. Siddharth Mukherjee come out of the post-mortem, whatever they call it, and say, we've discovered that the first problem are the clots. The clots is what in the lower capillary, smaller capillaries is what's killing off people. We spoke to all kinds of the good and the great across. And in that first month, Adrian, I didn't know who was listening or watching us. And I kept exhorting my colleagues in marketing saying, what are you doing? And is anybody watching? And what is this rubbish? We're spending all of this money. Can we have more people? And they were like, it's too early. We don't have an analysis. You have to give us time. When the first results started coming in, and remember, we were pretty much first off the block, Adrian. So simple technology, no design, because our offices were locked. Our designers didn't have access to the computers or the systems. Everybody was working off laptops in their homes. Our technical partners were sitting in Jaipur. So it was really just rudimentary. When the results first came in and we realized thousands of people had logged on to watch our sessions, we said, wow, okay, now what's next? So we started looking at programming some of the best names from across the world who otherwise would never come to Jaipur because it's too far or whatever, or they were too infirm. And we had everybody from the Dalai Lama and Margaret Atwood and Orhan Pamuk and so on and so forth. And Brave New World, in the first few months, garnered 4.8 million views. And we realized that we were sitting on a gold mine, but we weren't being able to realize the potential. And it was roughly then that we then started looking. Our next festival was supposed to be GLF London. And remember, Adrian, in GLF London, which we host at the British Library, our capacity is 1,200 people across three venues. When we finished the weekend festival of GLF British Library, we had 410,000 people having viewed it. So it just, again, blew our minds. We did the same thing for Meta, our theater festival, you know, which had a capacity of, again, 1,000 people a night in the theater. And here we did it over four weekends, as we've started doing right now again for 2021. And again, we had thousands of people logging on to listen to us attend this first virtual award ceremony, which was incredible, amazing, didn't have a glitch unlike the Golden Globes, etc. And it really gave the artists and artisans a platform to come back and feel alive.
So clearly a combination of your ingenuity, your reach, brand is important. Content is also, I would say, incredibly important. You've managed to get a big digital footprint. What are your thoughts about turning that into a business model?
Much more difficult, Adrian. So when we started Brave New World, this was obviously the million-dollar question. Were we going to be able to sustain ourselves off it? The good news is that there is money in digital. No, it isn't anywhere near what we would do in the physical space, to the extent that for every $100 that we used to raise, we now raise $7. But it's not that we haven't raised fairly substantial resources during this period of time. Not a lot of money, but certainly a couple of million is what we've raised by all of our digital products. Going forward, I really look at it because one of the things that we found is that while corporates always keep questioning you about your digital footprint and therefore their digital reach, they don't necessarily equate it to a money value. They still look at the old world having feet on the ground where you actually open a car door, you drink a glass of whiskey, and equate that to the money value. So I see really a combination of the two. To be able to continue to stay afloat, I have divested a further 5%. We're in the process, in fact, as we speak, Adrian. I'm doing a small divestment to a second group of investors, luckily who were very interested when we put the word out that we were in trouble, we needed some resources. And it was far easier because when our principal funders, which is IFC in Washington, CDC in the UK and MED in Canada, they said that they weren't willing to put in any money. So we said, can you free us and allow us to raise money, because we're going to find it very difficult to sustain. Because as I said, I haven't let anybody go. So we have salary bills and we have a lot of development. A lot of the money has gone back into creating a digital experience as we did with the Jaipur Literature Festival. So it wasn't just about design anymore. It was creating 3D microsites, which provided an experience. So we need money to reinvest in that. And we've rolled out actually 6 new projects. We're starting a big arts education platform called ArtGyan, which has been in testing for the last 3 months. And I think it'll finally go live in a month and a half, where you could be a one-stop shop for theater, music, dance, literature, film, whatever you want to learn, with masterclasses, with basic classes, and so on and so forth. We've started a new platform for craft, because when we realized that artisans were finding it very difficult to get to market, we said, why don't we do that for them? So we started the Craft Maestros or Earth Fables, the platform where artisans could put their wares on and we would then help access different markets for them, which has kicked off. We've started a new ideas exchange platform, which will be up and running in a couple of whatevers. And of course, we've taken everything else online. So we've used the opportunity to reinvent ourselves to some extent. But I see our first physical festival, or what we are planning, our first physical festival to happen, 100% confirmed, will be in the first week of September, Adrian, in the Maldives, in a wonderful resort called Suneva Fushi, which came to us with this extravagant bid. I mean, I had no idea where Suneva Fushi was. And they came to us with this very extravagant bid. And I was a little perplexed as to what were they thinking, or what had they woken up to, and exactly what substance were they smoking on that particular day, especially in the time of COVID. But they seemed to be convinced, and they persuaded me and my colleagues to come out to check them out, which we did in the first week of January. It's a green bubble. We have direct flights out of India to Maldives. They send their plane. Everybody on the island is tested. When you get there, you're tested. You're then put away into isolation for 8 hours while the test comes back. And then you walk around this island, which is just beyond gorgeous. And people stay there. And the offers, I think, start there at about rough $3,000 a night is, I think, their starting offer. And people are there for 2 months and 3 months. And people have just stayed there because of COVID. And Russian oligarchs and Europeans and Americans and vineyard owners and ex-royalty and all of this kind of stuff. And it was fascinating. So we're starting our first JLF, Suneva Fushi, 2nd or 3rd to the 14th. That'll be the first live event. And thereafter, we're planning live with a digital version, not digital live, we have realized that we have to post-produce everything that we shoot. And that's what we did even with the Jaipur Literature Festival. It was our learning. How do you get people to get a sense of outside of, you know, your Zoom box? So what we did for the Jaipur Literature Festival is, of course, we created a 3D rendition of the familiar festival, but we also went and shot the links at the forts and the palaces to give a sense of where people were. So everything we will post-produce with our television experience and then do the digital festivals. So we'll do a live festival, we'll not digitally broadcast live. Those will be exclusive for those people who pay or come to us or come free. And then a version of that will be put on broadcast across medium. We're using radio. We're, of course, using social media. We're using our microsites. We're using television now. Arts Alive, we put onto a television channel. We broke up the 6.5 hours and we spread it over 4 days and we put it out. So I really see now growing a niche festivals. In fact, when Glastonbury announced late last year, if you remember, Adrian, I was holding my head and I'm like, what on earth are they doing? Similarly with Tomorrow's World, when they announced and they said, we'll do both last year's and this year's. I said, why do they think COVID is going any place, certainly till next summer? And I do believe that you have to create a different kind of experience, much more niche, much more sophisticated, much more tailored to key audiences, key demographics. And that could be one of many models forward, because COVID ain't going any place in the world anytime soon. Even if the UK is 100% vaccinated, or Europe by September, Italy and Spain, remember, there's enough parts of the world which won't still have access. And even one of them come into Italy or India, I mean, just look at what will happen. You'll go back into the same cycle. And now more and more we realize that it's not that AstraZeneca or Pfizer or any of these guaranteeing you immunity. Yeah, it's not. They're basically saying, go back out.
Lifelong immunity.
Next year, yeah. And get your shot. So I don't see the situation really changing. So for those people who are still hanging in there, especially if you remember what I said in Singapore, Adrian, and I've used that a number of times, brick and mortar areas and buildings and cultural places, they really have to relook at the way they repurpose themselves and why they're there and how do they address the needs of the community in many different ways.
Right. And some of the tragedy is that we are overbuilt in the sense that there has been a long arc of investment in physical infrastructure. And then when the squeeze comes, you squeeze your variable costs because you can't squeeze your fixed costs. Your variable costs are people, they are art. They are the stuff that you're there for. You squeeze it and you end up with a sort of what I think of as zombie organizations where, you know, they wake up in the morning and what do they think about? They don't think, what is our mission? How could we realize it? They think, how do I survive? And so much of the more privileged parts of the institutional sector has regarded it as their agenda to build infrastructure. Like, why? It became an end in itself. The idea of buildings as an end in themselves rather than a means to an end has, I think, done long-term, not necessarily done long-term damage to the vitality of the arts, but it's meant that the vitality of the arts is not felt in these large institutional structures that suck up the money and the attention. It's elsewhere. It's outside of the buildings. It's in the sort of world, you know, of festivals. It's in the world of smaller organizations. But those, you know, those big, quote, anchors, unquote, my God, for the last 5 years, 10 years, they have been articulating their role as anchors. But when it came to the crunch, they didn't really think too hard about anchors. They thought, how do we keep the show on the road? What water can we bail out in order to keep these bricks and this mortar intact?
No, totally. And in fact, you know, what happened in Bombay, one of these large indoor performing arts centers which used to host big award shows and concerts, etc. And when they began weeping and crying, I said, why don't you just convert yourself into a COVID facility and, you know, charge 1,500 rupees a bed or whatever it is. And they finally did put in 4,500 beds. And that kept them alive. That's the need of the moment as well. And we're seeing that. The number of people who we're trying to help emerge out of this madness, because obviously, you know, we did a survey, Adrian, with NCPA, and which said that for every one artist who goes onto stage, the average number of people who help is 33, between the janitor and the lighting designer and the sound designer and the box office person and so on and so forth. So you're losing those kinds of jobs, which is huge. So we're trying to work with a consortium of venues to help them repurpose, reinvent, because everybody is desperate, right? Because one day you're opening up and the next day you're closing down. One day you're saying 50% and the next day you're saying no. And like most theaters, both internationally and nationally have said, you know, you keep saying 50%. We can't afford to be open at 50%. We're losing money. And most of the UK theatres have said this to us, that we cannot afford to open at 50%. So please don't talk about it, you know. And I think therein lies the challenge. And I really hope that your this year's GCDN conference will address this key need, this key issue. What is it that these brick and mortar places are going to do? How will they sustain themselves? They've downsized, they've got rid of people, but now what? And because of, again, my long hair, you know, I sit on a number of task forces, Adrian, and I remember in one of the first task force meeting, I was asked, I thought jokingly by a very senior bureaucrat and a minister, they said, Sanjay, you keep talking about artists and artisans, but why do artists need money? I thought he was yanking my chain, Adrian, and I was like, I took a double take and I said, why do artists need money? I mean, they have bills to pay. If they don't perform, they don't earn. And if they don't sell their wares, they don't earn it. I mean, they don't eat at night. It's simple as that. And I realized that their sense of an artist was the Shah Rukh Khans or the Brad Pitts of the world. And they had actually no sense of the life of the artists and artisans. So we started an advocacy program. Art Matters. And we started first with the visual arts, the traditional visual artists, because by which time I had bought every last painting there was. Every time an artist called, I haven't eaten, I had to buy something. So we started this program, and then very quickly it dovetailed into becoming a fundraising effort. We brought together 450 artists in a 6-hour, 56-minute mega show. I won't do it again, but again, it was an incredible show, which garnered a lot of money. We raised 7.5 million. Rupees, we were able to help 5,200 people. And all of this helped us learn. Really, it was that, a learning. Every time we did something, Adrian, we learned, we got better. And therefore, when we did the Jaipur Literature Festival this January, online with a 3D experience, and as of today, over 19 million people have watched it worldwide, with Germany being number 5. These are successes that you get, but it's also because of the learnings one has. And I do believe, and I've shared this, you know, in a number of talks, this is an opportunity. Yes, it's a struggle. Yes, it's debilitated, annihilated artists and artisans, but it's allowed everybody to reinvent. I think we've been so precious about the arts, and we've been so closeted about it, and so exclusive, not allowing people in, looking down at those who don't wear their tuxedos in a particular way, that we've forgotten that the arts is actually about humanity. It's about expression. It's about you, me, and the person next door, and the person on the street, and everybody else. And if you were to view that 6.56 hours, Adrian, it is vibrant. It's exciting. People have gone out of their mindset. They've reinvented their work. They have married existing work with new work. They've created work in their homes, but recorded it in interesting ways, merged it with visuals, created wonderful technology around it. And we are at a very interesting point. I don't see us going back. I mean, everybody keeps thinking, oh, we'll go back. We're going to open up. Open up. COVID is here to stay. 100 years after the Spanish flu, the flu is still around. May not be a pandemic in the same way, but enough people die. In the same way, even if COVID-19 disappears, something will come about. So are we going back? No. Can we move forward with some kind of experience, which of course allows you to come together in a safe way and have that niche, incredible occasion which creates memories? Because the digital format And the box doesn't necessarily create a memory. But when you meet, it creates a memory. But you do that in a particular way. But you look at technology to be able to take you to that next level. And you bring together, and this has always, you know, been a passion for me, Adrian, is how do we explain to people, especially in the education system, that is not about the arts versus sciences, or the arts versus technology, or the sciences versus the liberal thing. It's all of that coming together, you know, and it's really when your left brain and your right brain and you work together and you create something, as we are doing today, even as we speak, you in Italy, Gregorio sitting in Switzerland and I sitting in Delhi, we are connected. It's technology. And COVID-19 has forced us willy-nilly to take on board the possibilities of the future. And I think the possibilities of the future that the phone offers, creativity offers, the digital space offers is gigantic. And I'm hoping that by not necessarily, I won't use the word reinventing, but I'll certainly use the word evolving. Evolve the form in a way that sits and explores and makes possible the impossible. And that's really what the arts is about, right? And finally, I think the arts addresses the core need of the hour, Adrian. As the world becomes even more and more divisive, look around you in every country and you will see that this is the time that we have to look to the arts more importantly to be able to say that there isn't just one way or one truth. It's not about my way or the highway, but it is the arts that can show that many truths can sit together, not one greater than the other. Many realities can coexist at the same time. And expression, which is the need of the moment and the need for society, is an absolute imperative. That's what has got us the vaccine. That is what has got us to space. That's what will get us into the deepest oceans. And that is what will create the evolution of the human being. And it's about the arts. No time has it been more important today than now for the arts to stand up and to be celebrated and to be given that kind of freedom of expression and being.
Sanjoy, that was utterly inspirational, and I feel privileged to have been listening to it, and I think that our listeners will feel exactly the same. I think that what you have said is profound, and the deep thread of optimism that runs through what you are saying is profoundly valuable. I just wanted to end by saying that last time we met in the flesh. It was in New York, I think. You introduced me to a concept that, in retrospect, has been quite transformational in my life, and it is the mid-afternoon espresso martini.
Martini, absolutely.
Sanjoy, thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. More strength to you, GCDN, and of course, AE, and look forward to doing many things together. This is the need of the hour, and we all need to stand together in different parts of the world and just work. I mean, the problem is we've all been so fractured doing our own little incredible things. This is the time for us to come together with one voice.